I was about to take another swing at that thing with the blunt axe when a familiar powder blue 1980 Saab pulled into the driveway. Sloan got out, looking like she needed a favor. Well, hey, my friends, how you doing? Keith Tyler here, bringing you the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am truly grateful and pleased that you joined me. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Gabriella Stittler bring us our first story, and it's called The Usual Reasons. It was mild for January, and I was out back cutting down the rhododendron that had been an eyesore since the day Paul and I bought the place. A Cape Cod about halfway down a dead-end street close enough to the ocean to smell the salt in the air. I'd been meaning to cut the thing down for a year and a half. But when Paul got sick and illness shifts priorities and all those little lists he and I had cultivated over the years felt trivial. But with him dead and cremated and scattered discreetly over the side of the ferry that ran to Peaks, hacking away at the rhododendron gave me something to do, which was better than sitting around thinking about how the world was going to hell. I was about to take another swing at the thing with a blunt axe when a familiar powder blue 1980 Saab pulled into the driveway. Sloan got out, looking like she needed a favor. I leaned the axe against the shed and braced myself. Sloan had moved back from Los Angeles a few years earlier, and things were complicated between us for reasons that I didn't really understand. Hi, she said, smiling just enough to show off that slight chip in her front tooth from a beer bottle incident in her early 20s. It shouldn't have worked, but it did. She had a chaotic, crooked sort of charm that reminded me of our mother. Hi, I said, figuring she'd get to the point faster if I didn't filibuster about all of the things that I wasn't getting up to. You look good, she said, and forced another one of those crooked smiles. It wasn't a lie, exactly. I looked better than I had in a while, but it was unnecessary. From the way she was smiling and making small talk, she had every intention of slow walking to the ask. In the 32 years of our sisterhood, I noticed a direct correlation between the speed at which she got to the point and how bad things were. I figured I ought to get good and comfortable. "You want a beer?" I asked. Her shoulders loosened a fraction of an inch, and she shook her head. No, but I could use some water. We went into the kitchen, and I cracked a beer for me and one of those coconut lime-flavored fizzy waters for her. She took a sip. I took a sip. 15 years as a divorce attorney taught me two things. One, all people had it in them to be absolute jerks. Two, silence did the legwork better than questions. She looked at me. I looked out the window at the backyard and the gray sky and the blue jay that was aggressive as hell and had made itself right at home in the pine trees that separated me from the neighbor with the loud, supposedly friendly golden retriever. It's Maddie, she said at last. I fought hard to keep my expression blank. Maddie was her deadbeat ex-boyfriend who claimed to be handy but usually made things worse. From what I could tell, he wasn't employed and seemed to think that living like a child meant he was off the grid and independent. He wasn't my cup of tea, but then I grew up fast and hard for all the usual reasons that were nobody's business but my own. Living like a child was an indulgence I didn't have the patience for. It had to be bad if she was coming to me about him. What about Maddie? I asked carefully to keep my tone neutral. He's staying out at that old farmhouse off I-95, his uncle's place. She trailed off, and I got the sense that she was figuring out how best to say the next bit. I waited some more. "And he found something," she said, "something like it tasted sour." I said the next part carefully, knowing I was on the sort of ground that might earn me the silent treatment if I didn't tread just so. "I thought you and Maddie split when he got locked up a few months back." I hadn't asked what he'd been locked up for, partly because it was when Paul was at his worst, and partly because I was relieved he was gone. One less headache to manage. She shrugged. "He got out, and he's trying. We see each other sometimes." That just about broke my heart, because I took it to mean she'd resigned herself to being a sort of on-the-side piece that he could call up when he felt lonely or needed running water. Being a queen of self-control, I bit back all the comments I wanted to make. Can you just come and see?" she asked. "A quick trip, and you can always just walk away." I let out a breath of resignation, one Sloane was familiar with, and slipped on Paul's blue down coat. It was too big, but it still smelled a little like him, and I figured I needed some sort of good judgment for whatever was waiting for me at the farmhouse. There were a great many people I had no problem saying no to, but my baby sister was not one of them. It was warm for January in Maine, and everything had that gray, overcast tinge that crawled up underneath, no matter how many layers I wore and got good and comfortable. Sloane drove and didn't bother with the small talk, which I appreciated. We sat in a melancholy sort of quiet as she cut through town, careful to avoid those granite curbs that popped tires for fun, and headed inland. Maddie's grandfather had been a chicken farmer, and his uncle had stayed on and ran the place to the ground. It had been mostly derelict, other than Jerry, for a number of years. The farmhouse was made of clapboard, and was dog-piss yellow, and had a caved-in porch and a salvage yard's worth of rotted-out and rusted car parts around it. There was a large outbuilding made of wood, planks that were mostly decayed and crumbled in, and reminded me of a dinosaur skeleton. Sloane parked behind a busted pickup with a cracked windshield, with a little green pinecone air freshener dangling from the rearview mirror. Maddie's truck. I braced myself and got out. Maddie was sitting on a metal grinder, wearing a flannel workman's coat and smoking a cigarette. He didn't look happy to see me. "Annie," he said by way of greeting, not bothering to nod. "Matthew," I said back, knowing he'd hate it. He'd killed the cigarette in an empty tuna fish can and stood up. He was tall and lean and looked like he'd been wearing the same clothes for a few days. He gave Sloane one of those long side eyes that must have meant something, and she returned the favor. I pretended not to notice. "Well," he said, "come on." We went in through a side door with a broken screen. The kitchen was small, and the vinyl floors were duct-taped in places. There was an open box of cereal on the counter, and the sink was filled with dirty plastic bowls. There was a vague smell of decay about the place. Maddie handed me a headlamp. The whole thing felt ominous, and if Sloane wasn't at my back, I would have retreated. We went down the cellar steps, which trembled under our weight. The basement, if it could be called that, smelled like something wet and dead. The light from Maddie's flashlight and my headlamp skittered around the room. The foundation was cracked, and there was standing water against one wall. A few stained shirts dangled from a clothesline that stretched across the center of the room. There were empty paint cans in one corner, and a large pile of what appeared to be crushed cinder blocks in another. Maddie's light had stopped skittering and was fixed on something in the far corner. I didn't need to go closer to see what it was that made my sister desperate enough to ask for help. the body of a man whose head appeared to be smashed in, maybe by a hammer or some other heavy object. "Whoa," I said. Even in his crumpled state, it only took a few seconds to place him. It was Jerry Simpson, Maddie's recluse of an uncle. From the way Sloan and Maddie were standing and doing not a darn thing, I figured they'd already had a good long talk about how to play it. "I assume you didn't kill him?" I said. Maddie shook his head and went right back up the cellar stairs, not saying another word. It was Sloan who spoke into the silence, waiting until he was well out of earshot.
He didn't do it, but he's worried his little sister might have," she said.
I called the cops, and they came. First, somebody from the local precinct, a nice guy named Jim, who was nearing retirement and worked mostly at the school breaking up fights and scaring truant kids. He and Maddie knew each other well and didn't get along. I mostly sat in Sloane's car, sucking on some old mints I found in her glove compartment. She was stoked as hell and stood near enough to Maddie to offer him something, and he looked like a half-scowling punk who was ready to throw the first punch. The major crime unit came, and things were a zoo, and I stayed in the car sucking on those mints, answering only the questions that were asked. Sloan joined me. After our statements had been taken, we were told we could leave. From what I could tell, Maddie hadn't said a damn thing, and I watched as they cuffed him and put him in the back of their cruiser. From the look of angry resignation on his face, I got the sense it was the outcome he'd wanted.
"He didn't do it," Sloan said, maybe to me, maybe to convince herself, maybe just to fill the silence, which had become admittedly oppressive.
I knew I should walk away, go back to my house and that rhododendron and my yulings waiting patiently in the fridge. I should wash my hands of the whole mess. Worst case scenario, Maddie would end up locked up for a crime he didn't commit, which was no skin off my back. In fact, he'd be out of my sister's life with enough time for her to find somebody better. Preferably somebody gainfully employed who showered regularly. But then I'd always been like butter for an underdog, and it had been a while since I'd seen somebody as down and out as Maddie was, snarling in the back of that cop car. And if I was going to allow myself a minute to be romantic, it appealed to my better nature that he was trying to protect someone other than himself. "Why does he think his sister did it?" I asked, dutifully ignoring my good sense. Sloan shrugged one of her quick, angry shrugs. "Oh, he just does." I watched the cop car pull away and sucked hard on that stale mint.
"You know where she lives, his sister?" I asked.
Sloan nodded, and off we went. Maddie's sister, Amy, was 16 and lived in a trailer park next to the empty Kmart with her boyfriend and his mother. As far as mobile homes went, theirs was well maintained, with an American flag and some artificial flowers in pots on the stoop. Sloan agreed to let me do the talking. She went first, knocking on the door. A girl I took to be Amy answered, wearing a black hoodie and stretchy black pants. Her feet were bare, and her toenails were painted a coral pink. She had the same hazel eyes as her brother that seemed half tired and half angry. She looked a little like a pixie, with a nose that could only be described as cute and cropped red hair.
"We need to talk," Sloan said.
Amy didn't look happy, but she stepped back, and in we went. There was a mat with shoes, and Sloan and I took the hint and slipped off ours. The floor was scrubbed clean. We went into the kitchen that smelled like coffee and overripe bananas and a vanilla candle that was too sweet. In the background, I could make out the sound of old soap operas. On the wall above the cheap credenza were two large framed pictures. One, the typical high school photo of a serious-eyed kid with a crew cut. The other picture was of Amy.
This is Annie, Sloan said. My sister. The kid nodded at me with the wariness of a dog who'd been kicked a few too many times. Then she and my sister went right back to glaring at each other. I got the sense the two of them didn't get along.
What do you want?
Amy asked after a minute. Sloane kept her mouth shut.
We came because your brother is in trouble, I said.
She didn't look surprised, which told me something. What, I wasn't sure exactly.
What kind of trouble?
She asked.
Big trouble, I said.
What does Maddie's trouble have to do with you?
I'm a lawyer, I said.
He's in legal trouble and you want to help him?
Sure, I said, if I can.
The kid glared behind my shoulder at Sloane.
No offense,
she said slowly with a cynicism beyond her years. I braced myself accordingly.
But why would my brother's ex-girlfriend's sister want to help out?
Look, I said, choosing not to answer her question mostly because there wasn't an easy one to give. He had me come out to the farmhouse earlier today.
What the hell was Maddie doing out at the farmhouse? She asked,
more angry than concerned.
He had the place on Forest where he'd been staying.
He had to move out, Sloane said. He needed somewhere to go, somewhere where he could get his crap together.
Amy snorted, and I didn't blame her.
Thing is, I said, your uncle was dead in the basement, hit over the head repeatedly. Your brother is sitting tight at the precinct.
Her face hardened before my eyes, and I got the sense there was no love lost between her and good old Uncle Jerry, which explained why she was living with her boyfriend. I plodded onward.
You're Maddie's sister. You had access to the property, same as him. We wondered if you knew something.
Well, I don't, she said a little more quickly than she should have, leading me to believe that she did, in fact, know something.
I let my silence do the work.
I haven't talked to my uncle in years, she said, and me and Maddie aren't exactly close. He moved out as soon as he could. When he moved out, I moved here.
So you and Maddie lived with your uncle? I asked, pulling on a line she'd cast.
She clammed up tight at that idea, which told me all sorts of things.
Any idea who would want to hurt your uncle?
Some sort of brutal conflict was playing out on her face, like she wanted to say something, but also wanted me to go to hell.
Look, I said, I know you want to help your brother out.
She laughed at that, a hard, sad laugh.
You've been to the farmhouse?
I nodded.
He left me in that crap when I was 14 and only came back to raid the cabinets on grocery day. The place is too far to walk anywhere. One winter we ran out of heat. I didn't have a coat that fit, my shoes had holes in the soles, and I had to duct tape them together.
She took a quick minute to catch her breath, and then she went on.
So he's gone, and it's me and my uncle, and what can I do? If I say something and I'm picked up by the state, what the heck do you think's going to happen to a kid like me who gets picked up by the state?
I had ideas but knew better than to express them.
I've got a suitcase filled with everything I own and have nowhere to live but here. If it weren't for Sharon and Derek, I'd be on the street.
Derek, your boyfriend? I asked. She shrugged.
He's like a brother. Sharon watched me as a kid straight through elementary. We grew up together. This place is the closest thing to home I can get.
I had to give Sharon that much. The place felt cozy as hell.
You planning on staying here?
She shrugged.
In 6 months, maybe I'll jump through enough of those hoops to graduate. You think I have enough in me to worry about Maddie?
Sure you do, I said. The real question was, who might she worry about more than her brother? Because worry was written on her face. Next to me, Sloane kept her mouth good and shut. Amy didn't.
You want to help him? That's on you. But leave me the hell out of it.
I took that as my cue to leave, quick. Sloane followed.
Neither of us said much during the ride back to my place, which I appreciated. The sun was already half down by 4:30, and I wasn't entirely sure what to do with the little nuggets of wisdom that had been gifted to me. I said my goodbyes, which Sloane pretended not to hear, and went into my house. I poured myself a glass of Prosecco with a splash of grenadine, which reminded me of better times. I grilled a chicken breast and cut up an old baguette to make croutons and sat down for a quiet salad, listening to Yo-Yo Ma play a little Bach. It was the sort of thing Paul would have done for me on a crap day, and I felt marginally better after. I tried not to twist over the details that were rubbing against each other in my brain when my sister texted. "Well?" I resented that she didn't bother to capitalize, but then I was coming to feel like a relic from another time. "Come by tomorrow, first thing, 7, 9. I shut my phone off, feeling old and tired and a little disappointed in the world. Sloane rolled in closer to 10 than 9, but she had the grace to look almost apologetic, and she'd brought coffee and Dunkin', which was a nice gesture. I accepted. "Well," she said, settling into a lean against the wall in my living room. I'd painted it in seafoam green, and she looked like a watercolor portrait by Sargent standing against it. "You hear anything from Maddie?" I asked. "No." "And he didn't give any indication of why he thought his sister might be involved?" "No, he just said, 'Man, Amy,' that was it." The sun looked like it was trying to shine, but things were still surrounded by the haze New England winters are so good at throwing off. "Amy's not inclined to help her brother," I pointed out. "No," Sloane said, "she's not. Nobody is." I took a quick sip of the coffee. She did the same. "What do you know about Amy's boyfriend, not boyfriend?" I asked. Sloane crossed one arm in front of her waist and stuck her hip out the way she used to do when she was smoking. Her fingers almost looked like they were holding a cigarette. "Derek Osman works at a salvage yard. He's a few years older. He's always been around. He was a quiet kid that was always in the background when Maddie and I were serious." "What happened to Maddie's parents?" I asked, not entirely sure I wanted to know the answer. "He never said. I never asked." We stood in that speculative silence, and maybe we were both thinking about the same thing. Our mother died when Sloane was 1 and I was 11. Our father had worked hard at the shipyard, drank hard at the Legion, and left the rest to us. He was not a good father, but he was not a bad man. "Amy's lucky to have ended up with Derek," Sloane said. What was unsaid was an understanding of what her life would have been like before. We'd both seen that farmhouse. "Were you close with Amy?" Sloane shook her head, and I caught a whiff of what might have been good old-fashioned misplaced guilt. I changed the subject. "What do you know about Derek's mom?" "Sharon?" "Sure," I said. Sloane went back to tapping her fingers. She seemed bothered by the question, like she was twisting over what to say. "Works at Smithfield's." I knew the place, meat processing, known for hot dogs and quality bologna. When the wind blew just so, the smell from the plant carried across the highway and mixed with the ocean breeze. "You've got that look that you get when you're feeling a certain way," I said. Sloane let out a long breath and a soft curse. I know Sharon pretty well," she said. I waited. "She's my sponsor." "Ah," I said while my brain integrated new unexpected information. She cleared her throat and I stared out the window, thinking and feeling all kinds of conflicting things. "You like her?" I said after a minute. "She's a good woman, maybe one of the best I know." Her voice trailed off, and I got the feeling she wanted to apologize for something. But to the heck with that. I talked first. You remember when I was in high school working at the steakhouse by the mall?
She nodded, but gave me a confused look, which was fair. I went on.
I'd come home smelling like meat juice and cigarettes. I worked in the restaurant where the smoking section was separated from non-smoking by a velvet rope. You remember that?
Sloan nodded again, but still looked dubious, and it reminded me how vast 10 years could be. I wasn't really sure what I was trying to say or why, but it felt important.
Sometimes it seems like we don't make any progress, like we just go through all these motions to end up exactly where we were before things started. And then somebody reminds me that in my lifetime we had smoking sections in restaurants. Do you understand what I'm saying? We don't see the progress until 20 years later. Then something happens and you remember how things used to be. That's all.
From the look she was giving me, I'd said enough, maybe too much, so I stopped myself and took another sip of coffee and wondered what my mother would have said if she was alive.
Look, Sloan said after a minute, not meeting my eye, I know you don't like Maddie, but something like this would be it for him. No other chances, you know?
Right, I said,
and was starting to get the impression that this whole thing was about more than Maddie, that maybe there was some sort of redemption story, something more personal, something to do with Sloan, something to do with me.
He didn't do it.
Sure, I said, he didn't do it. So you'll help? It was phrased as a question, but it wasn't one.
Help is a strong word. I'll ask around, see what happens when I poke at things, but only if you promise that you will stay the hell out of it.
She broke into one of her crooked smiles.
You worry about me?
I debated telling her that it was the state of the world that concerned me, but didn't want to put a damper on things.
We made arrangements to meet later, and I stared at that rhododendron for a solid 2 minutes after she left, fantasizing about burning that thing to the ground.
The salvage yard was off the mostly empty access road next to a storage facility and piles of tarped road salt. Derek was of average height, but broad in the shoulders with a crew cut. He was looking at a transmission in a smashed pickup truck. His eyes narrowed noticeably when I pulled in. From his reaction, I figured he knew exactly who I was and what I wanted.
"You Sloan's sister?" he asked after a tense minute, wiping his hands on his blue canvas pantsuit. I noticed his knuckles were bruised. He noticed me noticing.
"And are you Amy's boyfriend?"
"Well, no, not really." His chin inched up defensively and said everything that needed saying. He had it bad. She didn't. Love being both fickle and brutal.
"She told me you came by yesterday, said Maddie's in trouble again."
"Yeah, it seems that way."
"She said that they found her uncle in the farmhouse and they took Maddie in for it. He's still in?"
"It's likely. He wasn't saying a thing when they picked him up."
Something flickered on Derek's face, and I got the feeling he was debating the merits of saying more. He reached into his pocket and started vaping, which was something I still wasn't used to. Cyborg cigarettes? I dug around in my purse for some of what sugar-free cinnamon gum, unwrapped it, and chewed. We stood in that thoughtful sort of silence for a minute.
"Don't take this the wrong way," he began, "but why is any of this your business? Sloan dumped his butt 6 months ago, and, from what Amy says, you never actually liked Maddie.
Not that I hold that against you. If I was Sloan's sister, I don't think I'd like Maddie much either."
"Do you think he did it?" I asked, my own question mostly because there was no good answer to his.
He kept right on sucking on that cyborg cigarette. After a minute, he hedged.
"I don't think he has it in him."
He sounded almost angry.
"Everyone has it in them," I pointed out, feeling suddenly cynical and old as hell. I'd chosen a profession where I'd seen otherwise rational people, good people, do and say horrible, vindictive things for reasons that I didn't care to explore. Thing is, I went on, I don't like Maddie, but if he'd really done it, he would have let the body rot somewhere under one of those trucks. He would never let Sloan see it. He sure as hell wouldn't have invited me in.
Why isn't he saying anything? Derek asked.
I didn't answer the question, mostly because I figured it'd be more effective if he got there on his own.
Amy.
Do you have it in you? I asked, but I already knew he did. Get the heck out of here, he said, any hesitation replaced by anger, and stay away. One lesson I learned from hard-earned experience was it didn't pay to provoke angry young men, and so I left. Smithfield's had standard shifts, which meant Sharon would be home by 6. So I waited outside her place, having picked up a copy of the Herald and coffee from the gas station 2 miles down. It tasted like crap, so I used a heavy hand with the hazelnut creamer, which made it taste like artificially sweetened crap. It was dark out, and Derek and Amy were already inside the trailer, moving around in the kitchen. At some point, Derek came over, stared at my car, and pulled the blinds. I half wondered if they'd called the cops. I was feeling tired and stiff and a little sorry for myself when Sharon pulled up in a small red hatchback. She was wearing a Smithfield's uniform and a black puffy coat that was unzipped and went to her knees. Her faded blonde hair was pulled into a loose bun. Everything about her looked tightly wound. She saw me right away and came straight to the car. I got out quick, wondering if she'd punch me, and position myself accordingly. I knew how to take a punch. I also knew how to throw one at one point. Sharon stopped short, reached into her pocket, took out a cigarette, and lit it. She had acrylic nails painted the same coral color as Amy's toes.
"You Sloan's sister?" she sounded tired.
"Annie," I said.
She took a long drag and let it out. Then she leaned against my car so she was facing the window to her trailer.
Amy told me you stopped by yesterday about her brother. Derek told me he's still locked up.
Last I heard, I said.
And you don't think he did it?
No, I said. I don't.
She wasn't looking at me. She was looking at the trailer's kitchen window and the shadows moving behind the curtains. The door opened and Derek's shoulders filled the doorframe.
"Come on in, Mom," he said.
And man, did he look young, standing there and calling out to her.
"I will," she said. "Let me talk to Annie for a minute."
He hesitated, as if on the precipice of coming out and dragging her into the trailer.
"I will handle it," Sharon said. Her voice was brittle and low.
He flinched and opened his mouth.
"Go inside," she said. "Now."
He did as he was told. She took another long drag, the smoke catching some of the street lights. Somebody nearby was cooking dinner with an open window and listening to sports recaps. I could feel the coffee in my stomach, in the back of my mouth.
"He's a good kid," Sharon said after a minute. "Works hard, does what he needs to."
"Uh-huh," I said.
"And Amy's a good kid, too, a good kid with a crap hand. Do you know what I mean?"
I did.
"Sure," I said.
She took another long drag and let it out and kept on staring at the window.
"It took him until 2 weeks ago to figure out what happened. That's the kind of kid he is. Can't see the evil in the world, even if it's bearing down on him."
"Means you did a good job raising him," I said.
"It was just us for so long, me and him, and then Amy. She's like my daughter, you know, came over every day after school, ate dinner with us, stayed a few nights. Then she was staying every night."
She took another long drag, let it out, and flicked the butt to the ground. It hissed against the moisture. I knew the day she told him. I saw it in his face when I got home, the sort of anger that would only get bigger with time and space. So I went out to see Jerry. If I hadn't done it, he would have. I knew, and then what? I felt vaguely sick and wished she would stop talking. I wondered if I had it in me to do the same. I imagined what Paul would do if he were in my shoes, in her shoes. Her voice trailed off, and we both knew what needed to happen. Sure, I said. I get it, really, but Maddie didn't do it. No, she said, he didn't. I took my phone and called the local precinct. I handed it to her. She took it and said what she needed to. I waited for her to finish and return the phone to me, which she did with an efficiency that I admired. She was the sort of woman who got things done. And then she turned and went inside. I waited in my car until the cops showed before driving home. I didn't feel like talking, but I didn't feel like being alone either. Sloane's sob was in the driveway, and the lights were on in the kitchen. I stared for a minute at the outline of that rhododendron against the streetlight and thought about how the blossoms in early June were a pinkish orange and reminded me of sunsets over the ocean. The window by the sink was fogged the way it got when the stove was on, and it made me think of Paul and his tea and the pasta he liked to make from scratch and the blueberry pancakes he'd cook on Saturday morning and all of the other good things in this world that I tasted, that I savored. Okay, I'm going to switch to the Alfred Hitchcock big book, the big book. Alfred Hitchcock's Book of Mystery, a story written by Mary Barrett. It's called One for the Crow. Ed chose the fast route, the new highway, which was engineered to bypass Ozark and go directly into the hills. Had he taken the old road south from Springfield, he probably would have lived a longer and happier life. He certainly would have enjoyed a more pleasant trip along a more scenic route than the one he elected. About 20 miles out of town, on an old road, he would have come upon a scene with the misty charm of a French Impressionist painting. From the hilltop, grapevines march down the slope in orderly rows in the valley below, as if protected by the hills from change and blight, lies the clean, sleepy town of Ozark, Missouri. From his vantage point on top of the hill, Ed would have seen the water tower rising against the green hills beyond and the iron-gray smokestack of the cheese factory. Had he continued downhill, he would have come upon an official sign, Ozark, population 800, and on a nearby tree, a less formal but more enthusiastic announcement, Welcome to Ozark, a good live town. Clattering across the Finley River Bridge and passing an abandoned mill with its rusty wheel forever still, he would have arrived at the Ozark Square where the red brick courthouse stands in the center. There are always a few men sitting on shaded benches in front of the courthouse, chewing tobacco and occasionally exchanging a few words about the weather, the crops, chicken feed, pesticides. Any of these local experts could have warned Ed about the risk he was taking, but he might not have listened anyway or heard what was said to him.
He was that kind of guy. Besides, a warning of sudden death in such a setting would be difficult for anyone to believe, for the scene is deceiving. All appears to be peace and rural contentment, but primitive passions and strong hatreds are bred in the hills, and old ideas and old grudges die hard. Just 5 minutes' conversation with one of the fellows in front of the courthouse would have given him a warning, but to gain a little time he missed his chance. The powerful engine of his big rented car purred quietly under the hood as Ed looked out the window with distaste at the scrubby oaks and hickory trees struggling for life in the thin topsoil. He felt a city man's scorn for wasted space and a successful man's scorn for what he saw as failure. "In this godforsaken place," he said to himself, "the hillbillies'll be glad for a chance at a little cash." Ed had a reputation in Hollywood for always being on top of any job, and he was certainly going to be on top of this one with no trouble. No trouble at all, he thought. He wheeled the car off the highway into a likely-looking farm-to-market road. It was pitted from the winter freeze, and Ed was forced to slow down. A thin film of dust blanketed the weeds and wild strawberries growing on each side of the narrow road, but no matter. The air-conditioned car was sealed against intrusion by the environment. Ahead appeared the first sign of habitation, a dilapidated farmhouse with a much-patched roof. One window was covered with cardboard, like a patch over a missing eye. A thin streak of smoke drifted from the chimney. A white hen clucked dispiritedly in the front yard. Ed turned the car off the road into dry grass, stopped and stepped out, slamming the car door. He looked around, speculatively. It was a clear, cloudless spring day, and after a steady hum of the car, the silence was startling. Far away, a meadowlark sang its pure notes. Ed walked toward the house. "Hello," he called. "Anyone here? Anyone home?" There was no answer. He rounded the corner of the house. There, bent over the red earth, was a tall, bony man in faded blue overalls. His skin, tanned to leather, was bare to the sun over the bib of the overalls. "What's the matter with you?" Ed demanded. "Didn't you hear me?" The man didn't look up. He said shortly, but with no animus, "Yeah, I heard you. Long ways off." Ed came closer. "Well, what are you planning there?" The man at last stood up. He looked Ed in the eye and said, "Corn," the monosyllable discouraging conversation. Ed tried to remember what he knew about corn. It was very little. He had seen some pictures, though, and they didn't look like this. "I thought you planted corn in furrows," he said. "Yeah, some do, when there's not much rain. Plenty of rain here. Plant corn in hills. 4 seeds to a hill." "Why 4? The man explained matter-of-factly. "One for the cutworm, one for the crow, one for the dry rot, and one to grow." "Oh," Ed said, unenlightened. "When will it come up?" "Yeah, tassels out about July," the man answered. Then, clearly dubious, he asked, "You thinking about growing corn hereabouts?" "Oh, no, no," Ed said hastily. "I'm just looking for local color." The man looked around at the familiar greens and browns of the landscape, and then inquisitively back at Ed. "The way people talk," Ed explained, "their customs, their folkways, those things." The farmer frowned. Whether disapproving or puzzled, it was impossible to tell. "Well, reckon you better come inside, then, and talk to Ma. She knows all about folks this way." Moving to the back door, he added, "I'm Luke Anderson. This is our place, Ma and mine, since we lost her son." Ed followed him through a squeaking screen door into the kitchen. It was cool and dark after the bright sun outside. A woman with gray hair stood at a stained sink shelling beans. Luke said without preamble, "This fellow wants to know about our ways."
The woman turned to them, her face expressionless. She wiped her hands on her cotton apron slowly and deliberately. She inspected the visitor as she might have scrutinized a mule offered for sale. Like her husband, the woman was browned by the sun, and like him, she was economically lean, without an ounce of unnecessary flesh. She pulled a straight wooden chair up to the kitchen table and put her hands on the oilcloth, palms down, as if preparing for a séance. Luke and Ed sat down too. "Why do you want to know our ways?" she asked with guarded curiosity. "Oh, we want to make a movie here in the hills," Ed said. "The setting has to look authentic, real, you know?" He was uncertain how much these ignorant people could understand. "We want to cast local people, in minor roles, of course, and we'll pay." The woman was clearly not impressed. She looked at him sharply from startlingly light blue eyes. "They done make a movie once nearby." "Oh, I know," Ed said. It had been a disaster. Every possible thing had gone wrong. The entire cast sick, equipment breaking down and even disappearing, and the director actually dropping out of sight, never to be seen again. That had caused quite a stir in the press. It was, in fact, the only thing which saved the movie from being a box office disaster. No one particularly mourned the loss of the director. He hadn't turned out any good work in years. The woman said, "Those other movie folk built cabins and pretend barns from stuff they brought with them. Those things are still there. Maybe you could use them for your movie and not mess up a new part of the hills." Ed smiled indulgently. "These people are so naive." "Well, I'm afraid it won't do. That old set is much too artificial. We need virgin territory. Of course, we'll improve it on some of it. But the old site is ruined for our purposes." The woman spoke quietly. "That is how it seems to us, too. Spoilt. Spoilt for living, spoilt for farming, spoilt for looking at. You think to do that here on the side of the hill? Spoil it?" "Oh, no, not at all," Ed said impatiently. "Don't these hicks understand anything? We'll bring new life to this place. Lots of tourists will come just to watch a shooting. There'll be new business, new money pouring in, lots of action." A glance passed between husband and wife, which Ed could not interpret. The woman put both hands on the table and pushed herself to her feet. "Well, since you're here, you best stay for dinner," she said. The meal was quickly served. She put the plates on the oilcloth. Ed looked dubiously at the food. There were ham hocks, beans, and hot cornbread with fresh warm milk. Ed managed to choke down enough not to offend. He thought wistfully of a cold martini and rare roast beef. "Well, I'll red up the dishes," the woman said. "You men go along to the front porch. We can sit in the shade and talk for a while." Ed followed Luke through the living room. Shades were down, and the room had the dimly lit appearance of being underwater. The faded carpet was worn through to the floor in places. A sofa, tilting on three legs, was covered with an afghan. Ed thought with satisfaction, "We could use this. It certainly looks authentic." They stepped out onto the porch. The floorboards were warped, and for a moment the wavy effect made Ed dizzy. They sat down in straight wooden chairs, identical to those in the kitchen. The woman soon joined them. They looked through the haze of the warm afternoon across the yard to a hill beyond. A wasp buzzed busily at his nest in a corner under the roof. "Hey, that hill over there," Ed said. "We could use that in several scenes. It looks easy to climb." The woman glanced at him. Her voice was soft, but clear. "Some say that hill should be let be. Most folks won't go there for any reason." "Oh?" Ed asked, intrigued. "It's the Bald Knob," Luke said, as if that explained everything. "Bald Knob?" Ed asked. The woman explained.
A bald knob is nothing but a hill with no trees growing on top. This one's different, though.
It's where the bald knobbers meet, Luke said.
The woman leaned her head against the back of her chair and gazed off into the distance.
It was a time, she said, when roads were bad and town too far away. We hadn't no protection of the law. No one to see that cows weren't stolen nor strangers didn't come causing trouble.
She paused and looked at Ed. If he found any significance for himself in the moment, however, he gave no indication. She went on.
Some of the men hereabouts got together to make themselves the law officers. They had their meetings atop that bald knob, right there. Sometimes at night a person could see their bonfire. Oh, it was a good sight. Made a body feel safe to know someone was there, caring. Then real trouble set in. Some outsider come and set to build himself a fancy house on Bald Knob. He liked the view, he said. We never had much truck with outsiders. They never seemed to catch our ways of thinking. This man was extra bad, building there on Bald Knob where our men had their meetings and not understanding why that was wrong. Well, he brought a curse to the hills and to all the folks hereabouts. We knowed 'twas him all right. No one else was new in these parts. There wasn't no rain for a month on end. The cows went dry, the hens stopped laying, folks was hungry, and we couldn't see no way out of this trouble. It was the outsider and the strangeness he brought to the hills. The hills don't tolerate no alien ways. Something had to change, so the bald knobbers came in the dark one night and killed him where he lay.
She paused to let the point strike home.
Then the real lawmen came from Ozark. They heard of what was done, and they said our men had to be punished. The bald knobbers came to trial, and the jury said they had to be hanged. One of those was our son.
The tone of her voice hadn't altered in any degree with that statement, and Ed could almost imagine that he hadn't heard it correctly.
The real lawman had trouble, though, when it came to carrying out what they wanted to do. No one hereabouts would do the hanging. Those men were our own, and nobody would have had it on his soul to kill their own folk, so the law sent off to Kansas City for a real hanging man.
Luke prompted.
Brought his own ropes. Yes, and built the gallows, one for each man, 12 in a row, right there on the courthouse square. People come from miles around to watch. On the hanging morning, they brought out the bald knobbers from the jailhouse, some men and some just boys, not yet to razor growed. Our son was one not yet a man.
The woman was silent for a moment in tribute to the blindness of justice.
But then a strangeness come. Seemed like that hanging man just couldn't get his job done. There was something didn't want our folks to hang. Some say the rope he brought from Kansas City was green and stretched. That as may be. Maybe it was something else. Anyways, the trap would spring and a man would drop through, stretching that rope with his weight, and dangle there with his feet bouncing on the ground. You can't break no man's neck that way. When it was all over, they couldn't hang but two. At last they just gave up and let the others go. No one had the heart for any more. The bald knobbers were let to go free and told to go away somewheres else. They never been seen since.
She gazed up at the top of the hill.
And yet there's some folks say their spirits never left. Some say that at least one bald knobber never went away at all. Sometimes you can see a bonfire on Bald Knob at night. Some say the bald knobbers do protect us yet, from strangers and the like.
Only the wasp buzzing made a sound in the still air.
Ed said, Well, that's quite a story. I'm going to climb that hill and see how things look on top.
Luke said quietly, I wouldn't if I was you.
The woman said, Well, go if you want. There was a warning in her tone and a promise.
Across the still afternoon, a mournful cooing sound came from far away. Rain, Crow, Luke announced. Means rain soon, for sure.
Ed looked up, unbelieving, at the clear sky and smiled complacently. Well, I better go take a look at Bald Knob now before the deluge.
He sat out across the dry, brittle grass. In a few minutes, Luke and the woman saw him start up the hill. Then he passed from sight in the oak trees. The two stood up.
It'll be all right, Luke, the woman reassured, putting her hand on his arm. He's there. I know he is. He'll take care of everything, just like he'd done before, with that other movie man.
They went indoors. Night came. Ed didn't return. A watchful person might have thought that he saw a fire burning up on top of Bald Knob as darkness set in. Then the storm struck. Lightning flickered on the horizon. The first huge, spattering drops of rain fell, bringing the odor of moisture on dry land. A howling wind bent the trees. The torrents of water poured from the sky. Lightning bolts flashed and thunder bounced from hill to hill. Luke and the woman looked at one another wordlessly and went to bed. The morning sun shone on a world washed clean and shining. Luke and the woman set out up the hill. Ed's footprints were washed away. There was no sight that anyone had been there before them. Luke found him just below the tree line. Above where Ed lay, the hilltop was bare. The big oak tree, which lay on top of him, had been split by a lightning bolt. Under it, Ed was crushed like a bug under a man's heel. The woman spoke softly.
Get him from out of there, Luke. We'll plant him in the hill, where we planted the other man.
Luke bent to the job.
It was our son again, the woman said with pride. He lured that man under the oak tree. Any man knows better than to go under a tree in a thunderstorm.
Luke intoned, one for the cutworm, one for the crow.
Well, my friends, that's going to do it for the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler saying, I really appreciate you tuning in. Tune in again next time, would you please? And make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.